Thanks to Vaughan and everyone at St Mary's for inviting me to be here tonight and to speak to you with you a little bit about some of the problems of homelessness facing us today in Britain and how Christians might want to think about how they can respond to those problems. As I'm sure many of you have read in the newspapers last week, homelessness is rising. The government's Department for Local Government announced last Thursday that 48,000 people have been accepted as homeless by local authorities in England last year. That's a rise of 14% on 2010, the biggest rise for 9 years. If we take the usually accepted figure of about 2.5 people per household, that actually equates to about 116,000 people accepted as homeless in England last year. And of course, that's only the tip of the iceberg. To that figure, we can add the 2,000 or so people sleeping rough on any one night. That's up 20% this February on the same period last year. And most charities think that's an underestimate. In their 2011 report, The Hidden Truth About Homelessness, the homeless charity Crisis, for example, suggested about half of those sleeping rough had never met with a homeless outreach worker and were therefore very unlikely to be included in those figures. And to these, we can add the perhaps tens of thousands of people who make up what experts call the hidden homeless population. That's people sleeping on floors, sharing sofas, living in abandoned buildings or caravans, or squatting. Confronted by figures like those, it's sometimes difficult to get our heads around the problems of homelessness, and it's even more difficult to think what we ourselves might do to help to tackle those problems. But of course, both the church and Christians more generally have sought to respond to the problems of homelessness for centuries. Whilst different people will interpret the form that that response should best take in different ways, often leaning on different interpretations of the church's teaching, for many an obligation to the poorest and most vulnerable in our society lies at the very root of a Christian theoethics. Today, some of the UK's most important homeless services are Christian services. The Salvation Army, for example, is one of the UK's largest homeless providers, offering some 3,500 beds a night to homeless people up and down the country. At the other end of the spectrum, Radford Road Church, just down the road here in Leamington Spa, opens its doors to homeless people every Wednesday and Sunday evening. And in my own hometown of Brighton, Christians and others have come together to operate a basic soup run, providing soup and sandwiches to all those in need every night, come rain or shine, for 20 years. This last example is, I think, especially important for two reasons. First, the Palace Pier Soup Run offers food and advice to anyone who asks. People aren't asked why they need help, or even if they're homeless. Help is offered to all without conditions. This notion of unconditional help is by no means the only approach taken by homeless welfare providers, Christian or otherwise, but it is one increasingly marking a point of difference between Christian and secular organisations in this field. For some Christian organisations, at least, it is an approach most obviously rooted in the concept of agape, or unconditional love. And it's interesting that these organisations are now drawing on the notion of agape rather than caritas, in an era when charity has often been caught up and understood as self-serving and somehow patronising. To talk of an underlying ethics of love may give the impression that the work organisations like this do is rather woolly or sentimental or even naive. I would suggest quite the opposite is true. Agape raises huge challenges, both personally for those directly working with homeless people and politically. It's an approach that has come under attack in recent years from both government and from secular organisations, and its approach, I think, we have to vigorously defend. Second, though most of the teams that make up the Palace Pier Soup Run are drawn from different Catholic churches across the city, a good many are not. Within individual teams, those with belief and those without belief work together, bound together by their concern for homeless people rather than by any shared religious beliefs. This coming together of the Christian and the secular represents an important new trend towards the post-secular. And that's evident in a number of arenas, but especially, I think, in the homelessness field. I want to return to these themes of unconditional love and of the post-secular later in my talk, when I begin to think through some of the ways in which Christians are responding to the problems of homelessness today. But what I want to do first is three things. As I said, confronted by the kinds of figures I quoted a moment ago, it's sometimes difficult to get our heads around the problems of homelessness and how we might best respond to them. So I want to do three things with you tonight. First, I thought it might be useful to talk just a little bit about the different ways in which we can understand homelessness. Second, I'll then briefly outline Christian responses to homelessness today. Now, that's a hugely varied landscape, and I want to focus on just two examples: Christian Suprums and the work of Christians in homeless day centres. Then I want to think through some of the most recent policy changes affecting homeless people and the challenges those policies present to homeless organisations and charities. And I want to finish by thinking through how some Christian groups are seeking to respond to those challenges in new and, I think, very interesting ways. So what do we mean by homelessness? It might be seen an odd place to start. Everyone knows what homelessness is. It's pretty self-evident. Homeless people are those people without homes of their own. They're people sleeping on the streets. But of course, rough sleeping is only one, albeit the most extreme, form of homelessness. In England, the government actually draws a legal distinction between two different homeless groups. And that distinction is important because it shapes which homeless people receive which kind of help. The first group are referred to as the statutory homeless. The statutory homeless are those people to whom local authorities have a legal duty to provide accommodation. That's a group made up of families with dependent children, pregnant women, the very elderly and otherwise especially vulnerable, in legal speak, and those people who have not made themselves intentionally homeless and, crucially, have a connection to the local area. The important point to remember about this first group is that these are the homeless referred to in official figures. 48,000 households accepted as homeless by local authorities last year. It does not include people sleeping rough. In fact, it does not include the majority of homeless households. Of the 100,000 or so applications to local authorities by homeless households last year, only 4 in 10 were accepted and legally defined as homeless. Now, for any historians here, the distinction between the statutory homeless, those who are especially vulnerable, who have a connection to the local area, and others may sound familiar. It's a reworked version of the old distinction between the deserving and the undeserving poor, with local authorities helping only the most needy, who cannot reasonably be expected to look after themselves, and, of course, who are of the parish. The second homeless group, defined by law, are the non-statutory homeless, all those people without the legal right to accommodation. Because many of those people are single, or at least do not have children, they're often referred to as single homeless people. The single homeless population includes those people sleeping on the streets, at least 2,000 people every night, but it also includes the 40,000 or so people currently staying in homeless hostels and night shelters up and down the country. These are the apparently undeserving poor. They have no legal right to help from the local authority, and they have to rely on charities, many of them Christian, for help of any kind, whether food, shelter, or clothing. In fact, all of Britain's Suprums, almost all of its homeless day centres, and 9 out of 10 of Britain's homeless hostels are provided by voluntary organisations. The single homeless population itself, then, is made up of both younger and older people, men and women. About 40% of single homeless people are women. A similar proportion are under 30. The vast majority, 9 out of 10, are out of work. One of the most striking trends in recent years, in London especially, is how many have come from overseas, with about a quarter of the people sleeping rough in London tonight from Poland. Britain's undeserving poor, then, are a very diverse bunch, and it's now increasingly recognised that many, though not being considered vulnerable by local councils, have a range of often complex support needs. Amongst those who have been on the streets or in and out of homeless shelters for many years, those support needs are often very acute. The University of York estimate that half of those sleeping on the streets for more than 4 years will have a chronic drug addiction. 48% will be alcoholics, and 36% will suffer from mental health problems. Those kinds of problems, together with obvious things like pneumonia, helps explain why the average age of death for rough sleepers in Britain today is 44 years old. Now, those kinds of facts and figures can give us a clue as to who homeless people are, but we mustn't confuse them with what causes homelessness. All too often people will say, well, a person becomes homeless because they're an alcoholic or because they have a drug addiction. But there's a complex chain of cause and event here. I think we need to think of the causes of homelessness as being a mix of wider changes in society that often hit particular groups particularly hard. Why did youth homelessness begin to rise so rapidly in the 1980s? Well, perhaps because income support was withdrawn from 16 and 17-year-olds in 1986, and the government then went on to reduce the level of housing benefit that anyone under the age of 26 could claim. Today, we face what the chief executive of Crisis calls the perfect storm of economic insecurity, rising joblessness, and a decline in affordable housing. So single homeless people are those vulnerable members of our society who can cope least well with the kinds of changes many of us today are living through. But before I move on, I just want to introduce you to one more way of thinking about homelessness with which you may be less familiar. We might ask why those people so evidently vulnerable with drug addiction, alcoholism, or mental health problems are not found legally so by local authorities. One answer might be the stigma that so many homeless people face in their day-to-day lives. Trying to understand why the homeless are so stigmatised, my American colleague, Lois Takahashi, has explored three possible reasons. First, she says, because mostly unemployed, homeless people are usually seen as either economically unproductive or an economic burden. In a society that places so much emphasis on economic productivity, on being a good worker, it's no surprise that homeless people are socially marginalised. Building on this, it may be one of the reasons we find the poverty that homeless people so obviously articulate so distressing is they remind us of the possibilities of our own potential failure. Second, Takahashi outlines the various ways in which homeless people disturb taken-for-granted norms of bodily aesthetics and behaviour. The problem here is perhaps less that homeless people are different from us than they do the wrong things in the wrong place and at the wrong time. So, for example, because it's so dangerous to actually sleep at night on the streets, many homeless people catch up on their sleep in the middle of the daytime. And because they do not have a home of their own, homeless people must eat, bathe, and relieve themselves on the streets in full public view, leading for many to what my colleague in New Zealand calls a sense of dis-ease. Finally, Lois suggests that the very fact that homeless people are homeless invokes a fear that for some reason they've either been deserted or have turned their backs on family and friends. In the academic jargon, that is, they're socially disaffiliated. And why does that worry us? Well, because we all live and grow within close social networks. And without those networks, there's no check on our possible behaviour. Another figure that often evokes those fears of disaffiliation, of course, is the stranger. someone whom we know little about, and whom we fear may not hold the same values as us, largely because they come from somewhere else. In an important sense, and homeless people are the ultimate strangers. And I think it's no coincidence that both historically and today we remain fascinated and a little fearful of homeless people's apparent mobility. That mobility is disturbing because it signals both the possibility that that person has turned their backs upon, literally moved away from, friends and family that might provide a check on their behaviour. And because having come from somewhere else, they may hold very different values to ourselves. This fear of the stranger is deep-rooted. It's one reason that under the old poor law, only those from within the parish were eligible for parish relief, a distinction that, as we've seen, lives on today in the contemporary homeless legislation. Of course, not only this fear, but also this sense that the stranger is somehow less deserving of help, is also deep-rooted. One of the basic principles underlying the action of those who want to help homeless people is that the care we naturally extend to our friends and families and neighbours should be extended to others. In research with my colleague Paul Cloak at the University of Exeter, we try to explore what it is that prompts this transformation from an ordinary ethics of care to an extraordinary sense of ethical commitment to strangers. In the homelessness field, one of the most immediate and obvious expressions of such care is to be found on soup runs. And in our own research, we made contact with over 90 soup runs up and down the country, and we're sure there are many more. Soup runs provide essential food and nourishment to homeless people, and they act as important signposting services. That means when we talked with homeless people, they told us that it was often soup runs that pointed them in the direction of other places, a day centre or a hostel, for example. All of Britain's soup runs are provided by voluntary organisations. Most of them are small local affairs. 9 out of 10 of them work with budgets of less than £1,000 a year. But the size of these budgets should not make us think that these are small affairs. Many draw on banks of volunteers which run into the hundreds, with any one individual only going out on the run once a week or once a month, perhaps. And of course, they're supported by a vast network of donors, local businesses, schools, and especially churches. In other words, a small group of people standing on a street corner or in a car park, serving tea and coffee, soup and sandwiches to homeless people in towns and cities up and down the country, is an expression of care that reaches far beyond that small group. Soup runs articulate a desire to care for homeless people felt by dozens, if not hundreds of people in that place, whether that care is expressed on the streets themselves, through donations, or through the food that people help prepare. One of the founding principles of most, if not all, soup runs is that the care they offer is for all. As one of the volunteers told us in our research, for example, anyone who comes to the hatch can have anything. You can't be selective, because you can't tell just by looking whether they're rough sleepers, unemployed, well-off, or whatever. And in contrast to many day centres and hostels, which will require a person at least to provide some details of who they are and of their circumstances, this care comes with no strings attached. As another volunteer told us, we don't ask any questions. We don't ask, what's your name? What's your national insurance number? Where do you live? We just give. In other words, soup runs are perhaps the most obvious and purest expression of agape, of unconditional love. But as I said at the beginning, we shouldn't think that such love is easy. Working on a soup run can be physically but also emotionally demanding. Volunteers can find themselves serving angry, depressed, drunk, and sometimes aggressive people. They're very often confronted by tales of great hardship and suffering. And working according to the principles of unconditional love does not absolve people from sometimes having to make very difficult ethical decisions. Modern welfare is based upon a principle of negative citizenship. What I mean by that is that in a modern welfare state, we pay our taxes, in part, so that we no longer have to make the difficult moral decisions of who is deserving of welfare and assistance. The state does that for us, and it absolves us of that responsibility. But on a soup run, volunteers are confronted by a variety of that kind of decision all the time. Though working to the principle of care for all, what do you do if you have 50 people to serve, plenty of sandwiches, but only 20 cakes? For someone on the streets, a cake might offer not only a tasty treat and a useful source of sugar, but precisely that, a treat, at a time when there may be very little else in their lives beyond the daily grind of survival. Every night, soup run volunteers are negotiating the boundaries and the realities of unconditional love in a context where such issues are far from abstract. So where does this prompt to the expression of agape come from? Where does the prompt to offer unconditional care towards disturbing, upsetting, and sometimes threatening strangers come from? The majority, though not all, soup runs in Britain are organised by churches, whether an individual church or a network of churches working both within and across different denominations. And for Christians, there is, of course, a very obvious source of this expression of compassion to the stranger, outlined in Luke 10, verses 25 to 29, the parable of the Good Samaritan. While some Christian organisations may draw explicit attention to this kind of inspiration in their mission statements and their publicity materials, Christian volunteers themselves often express a less coherent, or at least a less formal notion, of divine inspiration. As one volunteer said to us, for example, "I just thought there was a need. There were people that were really lost, and nobody cared a sausage about them, to be honest. And I really felt that God wanted me to do something about it." For many of the volunteers we talked with then, their work on a local soup run was the most obvious way to express their Christian faith. It was, in other words, a form of evangelism. But importantly, I think, an evangelism that is most often expressed in the form of quiet service rather than aggressive proselytizing. As one volunteer said, "I think it's a bit of an evangelical exercise. While we're not preaching with our words, we're certainly preaching with our actions." And another said, "But we don't force it on people. If we feel it's right to share about our faith, then we will. And quite often we will pray for people. But if they're clearly not interested, we won't bother them with it." But as I said at the beginning of my talk, not all soup runs are organised by churches, and certainly not all soup run volunteers are Christians. Very often people of faith and of no faith may work together on a soup run team organised by a church, but also perhaps by a college or a local university. This coming together of those with faith and of no faith, and of ethical principles inspired by Christian faith on the one hand, and most commonly secular concerns for social justice on the other, is one expression of the post-secular. A putting aside of any discussion and perhaps disagreement of guiding principles in favour of practical action. Another more complex expression of the post-secular is also evident in the extent to which the few secular organisations providing soup runs seem to base their call to action around something which would appear very close, at least, to Christian theoethics. One of the newest and, for me, most interesting organisations to emerge over the last few years in this field is something called the Sock Mob. The Sock Mob describe themselves as a social network meetup group. There are hundreds of meetup groups, and they organise around all sorts of different things, from flamenco dancing to world cinema to homelessness. The Sock Mob have no physical base. They organise themselves entirely on the internet. People who are interested in joining sign up via Facebook. And each week a member of Sock Mob, now several hundred people, posts a message on meetup.com, simply inviting people to join them for a walk in central London. Once out and about, Sock Mobbers engage homeless people in conversation, on the understanding that many homeless people would not have had any positive human contact for some time, and often feel very vulnerable, isolated, and quite frankly, ignored. But they also provide those they meet with a few essentials. It might be a toothbrush, a hot drink, or indeed a pair of clean, dry socks. Unusually, though, a look at SocMob's website provides no statement of principles or ethos. And though a small group of people work to ensure that there are regular mobbings, there's no official organisational structure through which new members are inculcated into a particular way of working. Yet if we think about what it is that sock mobbers do, they seem to share their approach with a number of other Christian and secular organisations in this field. Here's how the Simon community describe their reasons for doing something very similar. The Simon community accepts people who they are, rather than trying to tell people who they should be. When we make contact with homeless people, we do so on their own terms, and aim to live with them in a philosophy of tolerance, acceptance, and self-help. We aim to make the most immediate and concrete gesture of caring, without conditions, questions, or demands. Though not a Christian organisation, the SocMob includes both Christians and non-Christians amongst its members. It is, in fact, a post-secular organisation. But, significantly, I think, its approach to working with homeless people, one based around the principles of unconditional encounter, reveals a very complex articulation of post-secularism, one in which an avowedly secular group, or at least a group which declares no allegiance, religions, or secular, appears to be working with basic Christian principles of agape, an outpouring of unconditional love towards the homeless other. So Suit runs off of one of the clearest and I think perhaps simplest examples of Christian responses to homelessness. But there are other, more recent and more complex responses. One of those comes through Christians' involvements in homeless day centres. The day centres emerged in this country in the late 1970s, early 1980s, as a response to the very limited help that single homeless people receive from government. As with soup runs, the vast majority are run by voluntary organisations, though often they will employ paid managers and staff to help and manage the setup. The fact that so many of the people working in day centres are doing so on a voluntary basis seems to be very important to homeless people themselves. And interestingly, in seeking to explain that to us, Andy, a homeless man we spoke to in the St Barnabas Day Centre, framed it again in terms of love. This is how he described the volunteers at St Barnabas. Do you want your food? Because it's cooked with love. It's cooked with love. That's what she said. How can I put it? It's genuine. Do you understand? It's genuine. They care. They don't get paid to care. They volunteer to do it. And they do cook their food with love. Though St Barnabas is a Christian organisation, about exactly how many day centres are provided by faith-based groups is very difficult to ascertain. Some which started as Christian organisations have since moved towards secularism. Others are very unsure about advertising their religious affiliations. What are day centres? Well, in the simplest sense, they're a space of material resource. They provide people, homeless people, with a source of inexpensive or free food, with clothing and bedding. Over the last 10 to 15 years, many have added to these basic things with a range of much more sophisticated services. They provide laundry, showers, healthcare, benefits advice, help for people looking for work or accommodation, and help for people seeking treatment for alcoholism or addiction. Well, those kinds of goods and services are clearly important. They're vital. But as I've already hinted, I think we need to understand the importance of day centres in something more than only material terms. Let's take something as apparently mundane as the opportunity to take a shower. As I've suggested, one of the reasons that homeless people are so often seen as disturbing is because they disturb conventional codes of behaviour. Or, as one of the homeless men we talked to put it rather more bluntly, during the day, I think that's the hardest part of being on the streets, because people look at you and think, oh, that scruffy so-and-so. And yet finding a way of keeping clean when living on the streets is a major issue, especially over the last few years, and more places have closed their public toilets, or restaurants and businesses police who uses their toilets and washrooms ever more carefully in case they disturb their customers or aren't genuine customers. So understood in that way, the ability to do something apparently as simple as take a shower can take on enormous significance for homeless people. Because as another homeless man told us, a shower means you can almost be normal again. More generally, day centres provide a crucial space of refuge from the travails of life on the streets. For Andy, they offered a space of love and the kind of non-judgmental engagement and contact that the Simon community and the Sockmob talk about. For others, their importance lies in the sense that these are places where the kinds of behaviours deemed inappropriate, odd or threatening on the streets are taken as the norm, where falling asleep under a table in the middle of the day is fine. A space, in other words, where homeless people can be themselves without the stigma that so often accompanies their lives. But as I said, over the last 10 or 15 years or so, many homeless day centres have sought to move far beyond this basic space of refuge. Many, if not most, now offer their clients a whole range of additional support, from advice on benefits to access to drug or alcohol rehabilitation programmes. But this shift to a more complete service has raised some very difficult dilemmas for the groups providing day centres, and in particular for Christian organisations in this field. Put simply, the dilemma comes down to this. If not offering these kinds of additional services, how much do day centres actually help homeless people? Or how much do they really provide simply a holding ground for those who desperately need help, and they may find some respite, but without those services will never really hope to exit the streets? And if day centres do provide these services, to what extent should they require homeless people to engage in them? Should the use of a day centre be conditional upon a person looking for a flat or work or beginning to address their addictions? If so, how might this conditionality be squared with the underlying principle of agape, or unconditional love, which provides the basis for the work of Christian Sucrums? Unsurprisingly, perhaps, different organisations have come up with different answers to these very difficult questions, with three broad trajectories apparent. The first one is broadly in fitting with the concept of agape, described here by the manager of the Missing Peace Day Centre in Bristol, for example. Support, meals, we don't impose any of those things. It's open access. If you want to sit here all day on your own saying nothing, that's fine. Nobody's going to challenge you. The second approach is more commonly described as a philosophy of empowerment. So offering people the opportunity to offer these kinds of services, but not demanding that they do so. In practical terms, for the manager of a Methodist day centre, this means working with a fundamental belief that people need acceptance first. As we build relationships, then opportunities may arise for challenging people. But the place we want to start is some kind of trust. The third approach is most usually referred to as underpinned by a philosophy of active intervention and change. Here, anyone who wants to make use of a day centre must demonstrate a willingness to change, with even basic services, a meal, withheld from those who do not do so. Crucially, I think, these are not abstract ethical questions. The approach that different day centres now take, indeed can take, are highly circumscribed by government policy. And I want to finish by outlining some of the most recent and important policies in this field, their effects on homeless people, and how Christian organisations working with homeless people are responding to those policies. Though the vast majority of day centres are provided by voluntary groups, many are reliant to a greater or less extent on government funding. Such funding accounts for about 75% of the income of about a third of Britain's day centres. But that funding comes with strings attached. In 2006, the Labour government introduced a programme called Places of Change, and they demanded that day centres wishing to access funding did indeed become places of change, requiring them to demonstrate the changes made by their clients in relation to all sorts of targets, the take-up of accommodation, of work, or a place on an alcohol or drugs rehabilitation programme. That programme's now finished, but the approach it introduced has been widely adopted and continues as a requirement to access many of the funding pots available to charitable day centres. In fact, the approach has extended beyond day centres to the streets. For example, homeless outreach teams, they're the guys who go out on the streets to make contact with someone sleeping rough and bring them to a centre, are now working with what they describe as an assertive approach. At its most extreme, assertive outreach includes serving homeless people who are engaged in begging, for example, or street drinking, with an antisocial behaviour order, unless they desist begging and street drinking. The antisocial behaviour order may commonly ban them, for example, from the city centre, and those who break the order are imprisoned for up to 6 months. They describe this approach as coercive care. Now, leaving aside for the moment whether the notion of coercive care is in fact an oxymoron, it's clear that such approaches can lead to real and lasting improvements for many people. The more active approach in day centres has furnished many homeless people with essential life skills, which enables them to sustain accommodation of their own, for example. And though certainly assertive, the antisocial behaviour orders have led some homeless people into treatment programmes. But for those unable or unwilling to engage, these kinds of approaches at best set people up to fail, and at worst can lead only to further and more entrenched exclusion. Now, though it's not possible to trace these divisions along purely faith lines, increasing divisions are evident in the homelessness sector, between mostly larger secular organisations adopting this more actively interventionist approach, including assertive outreach and coercive care, and those mainly Christian organisations retaining an ethos of either unconditional acceptance or empowerment. Those organisations have eschewed any government funding, and they certainly refuse to engage in assertive outreach. But it's not only that those choosing not to work with an actively interventionist approach are now starved of funding. As that approach gains ground, it seems that for government and many secular organisations, there is no room for other approaches to the care of homeless people. Most obviously, the last few years have seen growing criticism from both government but also very large homelessness charities directed at Britain's soup runs. For those favouring active intervention, the problem with soup runs is very clear. Not only may they do very little to help homeless people, beyond meeting their basic and most immediate need for food, but they may help, apparently, sustain a street lifestyle. Because those who would otherwise spend what little money they have on food can now spend it on drugs, for example. Such criticisms are very wide of the mark. As I suggested, soup runs provide a crucial signposting service. The research evidence also suggests that where there are no soup runs, rather than waste their money on food, homeless people with addiction will simply go hungry, obvious risk to their health, or they'll simply steal the food they need, at obvious risk of a criminal conviction. And yet, taking this critique of soup runs to its logical, if frightening, conclusion, in February 2011, Westminster City Council sought to ban the free distribution of food in public places, with the notable exception of commercial companies involved in promotional activities. You can still hand out Coca-Cola and Mars bars in Westminster, but you cannot feed the homeless. Westminster Council defended their actions with claims that they were merely acting in the best interests of homeless people themselves, that they were following a philosophy of active interventionism and change. But it's not difficult to see other motives at work. The proposed ban on soup runs came just a year before the London Olympics, at a time when Westminster are desperate to promote London as a tourist destination. The government's most recent programme, No Second Night Out, introduced in London last year, are now being rolled out nationwide raises very similar concerns. No Second Night Out puts outreach teams in contact with homeless people new to the streets within 24 hours, so that no newly homeless person will have to endure a second night out. Having made contact, the homeless person is taken to a reconnection hub, where they may stay for up to 48 hours, as workers seek to reconnect them to their local area, putting them in contact with services and support, and providing them with a ticket home. In the case of people from overseas, a coach ticket to Poland from Victoria Coach Station. On the face of it, such a programme may seem like an excellent idea. Looking at it more closely, I think we need to ask some very serious questions. Most obviously, perhaps, we know that many single homeless people have a range of often very complex needs. Whether those needs can really be assessed in 48 hours before that person is then shipped off elsewhere is deeply questionable. We also know that some homeless people have very good reasons for leaving the place they became homeless. Indeed, they would presumably not have moved away from that place if they had services and support they could draw upon. If that's the case, it's difficult to see what sending them home might achieve. You might want to think what that kind of approach would mean in a city like Warwick. There are very few services for single homeless people in Warwickshire. If someone from Warwickshire is turned away from the night shelter in Leamington Spa, because not local to Leamington, where might they go? Since under No Second Night Out, they're not entitled to access services in any other county. In fact, there's little or no evidence to suggest that Second Night Out has been a success in London, at least for homeless people themselves. The team employed by government to conduct an evaluation before it was rolled out nationwide were, in fact, explicitly refused the opportunity to trace the outcomes of those who had been reconnected. In other words, they weren't allowed to see whether those people had access support. Indeed, they weren't allowed to look at whether they'd even made it home. Looking at it like this, far from the latest incantation of a new approach to the care of homeless people, No Second Night Out starts to look remarkably like a very old approach to managing homelessness. As under the Poor Law, only local people would be allowed to access local services, with the others sent on their way. But the reasons behind this return to older styles of management have a very contemporary logic. With the attempted ban on soup runs in Westminster, No Second Night Out is most easily understood as an attempt, first by central London governments, boroughs, but now by cities up and down the country, less as an attempt to tackle the problems of homelessness, and more simply to clear homeless people out of the way. We don't mind what you do, where you go, just not here. In Westminster, the spark for that would appear to be the Olympics. Elsewhere, it's likely to be simple economic expediency. Why should we care and pay for somebody else's problem? And in cities that are desperate to present an image of health, wealth, and happiness, how else will they attract investment and new residents? They can't tolerate the presence of those who most obviously contradict that image. So in finishing, what does all this have to do with the church? And how might Christians best respond to this changing landscape of homelessness? The first thing I'd say here is that there is clearly not, nor perhaps could there ever be, a singular Christian response to such issues. As the differences between Christian soup runs advocating an approach rooted in agape, or unconditional love, and Christian day centres working instead with a more active notion of empowerment, important and genuinely held differences are apparent in how different Christian organisations and different Christians are seeking to respond to the problems of homelessness. Rather than seeking to judge which approach is most appropriate, we may do better to realise that different approaches suit different forms of response and different homeless people. Whilst agape seems a reasonable, indeed I would suggest essential, underpinning to the work of a soup run, if day centres are to help people move towards a solution to their homelessness, We need an approach that encourages people to take up the opportunity for greater help if they so desire it. But it seems to me that the move towards active intervention and care, at least as currently entangled in notions of assertive outreach, a ban on soup runs and no second night out, is antithetical to basic notions of Christian love for both one's neighbours but also for one's strangers. What we need to do, I think, is disentangle this approach from those more sinister developments. Only then can we have a proper debate, initiated from a square starting point, about what kind of response might be most appropriate to homeless people's own needs rather than the needs of others or of the local economy. And the need to do so is ever more pressing. As austerity really begins to bite and the government housing benefit reforms come into effect, homelessness is set to rise very significantly. At the same time, homelessness charities up and down the country are reporting very substantial cuts to their funding. In fact, the umbrella organisation, Homeless Link, report that 30% of homeless hostels and night shelters have suffered a reduction in their funding of 25% since 2010, leading to the loss of 1,800 hostel beds. More and more organisations are reporting that they are having to shed their professionally trained staff and employ more volunteers. Those volunteers simply do not have the training to provide the kind of intensive support demanded by a more actively interventionist approach, and in likelihood, this approach will continue to be less and less effective. But we may want to finish by thinking about some of the opportunities the cuts may open up. Christian organisations have long proven it's possible, even if difficult and certainly not desirable, to offer services for homeless people with little or no financial support from government. Given this, a Christian presence in this field looks set to continue. And as other organisations come under increasing pressure, perhaps to increase. In light of this, it may be that Christian organisations can acquire a stronger voice in any discussion of homeless people's needs. Certainly it seems to me that as well as continuing their work on the ground, Christian groups must develop their campaigning role. It's important not only to serve homeless people on the streets, but to act as advocates for them, to oppose austerity, and to oppose the current and regressive measures being taken against those suffering most from austerity. One of the organisations that most inspires me is the broad-based Christian Alliance Housing Justice. It's Housing Justice that led the opposition to, and eventually overturned, Westminster's attempt to ban soup runs. But they did so working alongside other secular organisations, SocMob included. And perhaps it is indeed in the post-secular that the most effective responses to homelessness might emerge. Thank you.